Lodge and Hopewell Gardens. Do all the things you wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 1-800-441-4410 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome to FW Presents, the anthology show for the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is another installment of Mountain Comics, the show where I look back at the comic books I bought while on vacation with my family in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 1980s. And joining me in the cabin this week is a returning guest, Sean Ross. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how's it going, man? I'm not so much a returning guest as I hid in the champagne-shaped bathtub, and you never saw me. I've just been in the cabin all year. I smell.
I wondered what gurgling noise was, but now I know. Okay, fantastic. Yes, of course, Sean was here for season two. What did we talk about? Oh, Marvel Team-Up, right?
No. We talked about the beautiful gem that is Iron Man 200.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Was that season one then?
I think it was season two. Yeah. It was the Denny O'Neill, Mark Bright, kind of the wrap-up of their arc.
That's right. Okay, all right. Yeah, they all blend together after a while. So anyway, I'm really thrilled to have you back. I always enjoy talking to you, so this is very exciting. We're here to talk about Batman number 389, which was on sale August 8th of 1985, because, of course, someone has to talk about Batman on this damn network, because obviously Chris and Ryan are doing it. before we get to the plot, I do want to ask you, like, why did you want to pick this one to talk about?
It's funny, when I saw your list, I was like, I jumped at this one, because this was around when I started collecting Batman comics. I mean, I'd been collecting for a little bit by this point. I started collecting in like 1983, but I'm, you know, like everybody else, I kind of did it piecemeal. So I bought G.I. Joe first, you know, that was my gateway drug, you know, and then I got to like the X-Men and some other things. And I have these like sporadic Bat issues, you know, from a while before this one, but this was when I must've hit like a 7-Eleven or a Circle K that had like regular newsstand distribution. So my Batman collection is really spotty, but from around this issue on, it's really consistent. And so when I saw it, I was like, oh, I love that era. Because, you know, you always love the era you start in. And yeah. I haven't really had a chance to go back and revisit it in a long time. So I was super excited. I was like, oh, yeah, perfect. Cool. This is going to take me right back to like walking home with a slushy and a copy of Batman. Like that is the archetypal kid comic book experience, right?
That's fantastic. Oh, awesome. So before we get to the story in question, I want to talk about, of course, the cover, which is by Tom Mandrake. And this is – it doesn't mention it anywhere on the cover, thankfully, but this is sort of an unofficial crisis tie-in because it's all about the red skies that are happening over Gotham City and, of course, the world at this point. And the cover is – again, it's by Tom Mandrake, and it's all in various shades of reds and pinks, which is a nice effect. You've got Batman leaning over this gargoyle, and then in the back, Night Slayer. And then in the sky, you've got these sort of ghostly images of Nocturna and Catwoman looking on. The rain is pouring down. And one of the things I really like about this cover, aside from the monochromatic nature of it, because Batman is entirely in reds, which is just cool to see. I love that on the logo, they knocked out the color for Batman. And so the red skies are poking through the lettering. And the lightning bolt, it's you know, you see the black of the bat, but the letters Batman are transparent, which is, I think, is a really nice extra little effect. And I'm, as a graphic designer, I always have appreciation for back when you had to do this stuff by hand. You know, like this wasn't the computer where you could just hit a button and knock it out. This required extra work just for this nice little effect. So I think it's a really handsome cover.
Yeah, I can see why it jumped out at me off the spinner rack, because I think the pink, I'm kind of a sucker for monochromatic covers, and I'm especially a sucker for non-traditional colors on covers. So like Alpha Flight 12, you know, like some great pink covers, you know, jump out at me. And this really jumped out at me. And I like what Mandrake's doing. Mandrake he's such a moody, you know, like kind of atmospheric artist. I mean, he's like the bastard son of Gene Colan, I think. And
I think he'd probably like that if he called him to his face. I think that's a compliment.
In a totally good way. And this is just a great, you know, gothic kind of noir cover. And it's, the pink, especially in the red. And I think symbolically it's really nice too, because in this issue and then in the kind of surrounding issues with Nocturna's story, it's one of the few places in DC Comics at this time where the red skies were more than just a nuisance or an observation. Like they play a symbolic and thematic role in this series and in this arc in particular. So I like that it's referenced on the cover.
Yeah, absolutely. And this issue was written by Doug Menick, by the way. This was in the middle of his long run on the Batman comics. And Doug Menick is, I never know how you pronounce that. No matter how I say it, I seem to get it wrong. He seemed like one of those guys that probably didn't have a lot of time for these sort of massive continuity crossovers. He just seemed more like a guy that wanted to tell stories. Mm-hmm. And so I could see him probably grudgingly having to work the crisis into his stories, because this is a Batman that just doesn't really seem to fit in that same world. But he found a way to do it. Like, he found a very Menicky way to do it, of like, okay, we have to tie this in somehow, but let's localize it and examine what these red skies mean to the people of Gotham City. So it's a tie-in, but it's not like the Monitor shows up or anything like that. So to me, it feels – I could see that this is the way Doug Menick would want to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's really smart. It really – instead of, like, you're right. Like, instead of him, Batman swinging through the skies and Harbinger's in the background, and oh, a crisis tie-in, you know?
Right, yeah.
This is so cool, because what he basically does in this arc is the red skies, like, put a lid on the world. And it makes everything feel really claustrophobic and sort of extra somber and sad and dangerous. And then, as we'll talk about as we get to the issue, it plays a big role in what Nocturna chooses to do in this issue and in actually the issue that follows. So I loved it. I'd forgotten how well he had done this, because I was such a young kid when I read this. But it's really brilliant. In fact, it reminds me of my favorite Crisis tie-in issue is the Swamp Thing one. Mm-hmm. Where John Constantine ends up on the Monitor satellite, which is just – I mean, talk about the basis for a great short film, right? Like John Constantine meets Jay Garrick. Like, it's just great. And I love that crossover, because it's such an unusual look, and it's such a human look at, like, oh, this is terrifying. Like, this is not something you should be okay encountering as a human. It should break you. And Munch, I always say Munch, but I think that's because of the character on Law & Order SVU.
Right, yeah.
You know, I think he's definitely playing with those ideas of, like, you know, if the skies really turned red and there was red rain falling, like, it wouldn't just inspire a Peter Gabriel song. It would also, like, scare the hell out of everybody around. And so I liked that, because it would be terrifying.
Now I'm sorry that Peter Gabriel song wasn't on the radio at the time that I bought this, because I like to end every episode with a song that was playing on the radio when I bought this comic. And that would have been the perfect button for this episode, but that song was not on the radio at the time, unfortunately. But yeah, you're right. That Alan Moore one is really good. And again, that's another writer that probably regarded these crisis tie-ins, you know, rolling his eyes really hard. Like, all right, okay, we'll find a way to do it in my own particular style. We're not going to have the shadow being show up or anything like that. So anyway, yeah, let's get to the story. It's called Red Skies, as I said. It's by Doug Menick or Munch, however you want to say it. Tom Mandrake, John Costanza, Adrian Roy, and Len Wein is the editor. The skies have turned red, but in Gotham City, life goes on undisturbed. Commissioner Gordon summons Batman to inform him about the return of Catwoman to the city and her connection to a series of murders that have been taking place. Meanwhile, Nocturna has returned to the abandoned Gotham Observatory to study and understand what has caused the skies to turn red, but the authorities are alerted to her presence when she removes a street gang from the place. The next day, Bruce Wayne visits Vicki Vale at the gym she has been going to in order to end their relationship for good. But she wouldn't listen to him, thinking that what he wants is to resume their romance. At that moment in Wayne Manor, Jason Todd calls Amanda Grosh, I don't know how you say that, from the Child Welfare Bureau in order to talk about his deceased mother and the need he has for a mother figure. At night, Batman finds Catwoman near the corpse of a member of the False Face Society, but she explains that she is not responsible and is actually hoping to stop the killer. Batman takes the chance to tell Catwoman that he still cares for her and thinks about her, but ultimately that they can never hope to be together. With this heartbreaking development, Catwoman resumes her quest to find the killer, who is none other than Night Slayer, as he is convinced that the False Facers are all working for Nocturna, and he is seeking revenge against her. The next day, Jason Todd hears rumors of a pale lady at school, and a woman calls Harvey Bullock to inform her about the disappearance of her husband, who has only left hundreds of written pages in adoration of a pale lady. At night, Bullock and Robin go to the abandoned observatory, and while Bullock is looking for the missing security guard who was hypnotized by Nocturna, Robin finds her and lies to Bullock in order to get him to leave the place. Jason then approaches Nocturna and finds her troubled as a result of the red skies, changing the night forever. But Jason can't help but ignore such events as he finally decides to call her mother. Wow. So, all right, a lot of crazy stuff happened in this issue. Overall, what are your thoughts about this comic?
It's a loaded issue, and I'm trying to flash back to when I bought it as a kid. I was super young when I bought this, and it's very much a middle part of a really long arc. In fact, the Nocturna arc goes on for a long time. It's she's introduced
for
in like
years, yeah.
Oh yeah, she's introduced in Batman 363, and then this arc goes on for two more issues. So
right.
It's a good like 2.5 years of her as a major player. In fact, because I checked in on Batman at this time, this is like the origin of my collecting of the series. I have this outsized idea of Nocturna's importance in the Batman mythos. I'm like, Talia, Catwoman, Nocturna, like, you know, I'm the only one with her on that list, but it's because of this arc. So
every movie, you're going to every Christopher Nolan movie, you're like, where's Nocturna showing up in this?
And I was like, come on, you couldn't find some pale Irish woman? Like, you know, there's plenty of them people. Just go to Wisconsin. There's plenty of people. And so, so yeah, it's very much a middle part of the arc. And so my memory of the next two issues was much stronger because that's kind of where it's wrapped up. But in going back and reading this, I am kind of shocked by how strange some of the sexual undercurrents are in this book. And I don't know if that jumped out at you too, but that is definitely something I wasn't expecting in my pre-crisis Batman comic.
I mean, Batman's got women coming and going here in this car. I mean, he's talking to Vicki Vale. He's got Catwoman. There's Nocturna. I mean, he's kind of, I don't know. Menix's view of him is kind of a more virile sort of
yes.
Batman than a lot of yes. other writers. And they're on under some writers. I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, Talia al Ghul is always one of a love interest. But there have been some writers that seem to regard Batman as almost like a monk-like figure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just care about justice. But I mean, he's got they're all over the place here. I mean, it's kind of amazing, really, of how much of like female entanglements Batman's got going on.
Yeah, and I like that. I liked dipping back into pre-crisis Batman. Before he was, you know, Bat God, when he was like uncertain and he made mistakes and people could actually get away from him. Like the Night Slayer literally gets away from him the first like 10 times they meet. It's almost embarrassing. The newspaper even makes fun of him in the comics, which is pretty funny. But I was really surprised because, you know, he sees Catwoman, he meets up with her and he's like, hey, I want to show you something. And he takes her back to the Bat Cave. And already there's like a million kind of jokes writing themselves as he's taking her back. But then he's like, oh, there's this stalactite, you know, in the stalagmite, sorry, hanging from the roof of the cave, and it's dripping water, and it's dripping water on this other rock formation, which it's making it look like a cat. And one day, the phallic stalagmite and the cat rock will fuse. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, are you like, it's like this was co-written by Prince and Chris Claremont. Like, this is the most purple prose on the planet. And then Catwoman is like, oh, okay, cool, dude. Like, you're telling me you want us to be together. Like, that's a beautiful symbol. And he even says, like, I come here often and I think of you. She moves in to hug him and he goes, and we will be together. The stalactite and the cat rock will be together, but maybe not in this lifetime. And I was like, you bastard. Like, what a jerk. He's such a jerk. He takes her back and he's like, look at this rock. It makes me think of you, Selina. But like this rock, I'm unmoving. And it's like, oh my God, dude. Like I just was so troubled by this whole moment. And he just read to me like a 12-year-old boy, basically. Like it was like reading Ryan and Kelly from The Office. Like I just couldn't get my head around his actions in this moment. And that's only one of the really strange things in this book. But well, I'm curious what you thought about that interaction. Like what was he doing?
Well, I can safely say that at 14, when I bought this comic off the stands up in the Poconos, I did not get any of that subtext. You know, that at 14, I mean, I barely understand it now. But at 14, I was like, oh, all right, whatever. He's just kind of a weird rock formation. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in this that it's got some weird sexual dynamics at play. I mean, there's a scene early on in the book, page 3, actually, where Selina goes to visit Julia goes mm-hmm. to visit Vicki Vale at her office. And she's busy. Vicki Vale is throwing darts at a picture of Bruce Wayne. And there's this – maybe it's the way Mandrake drew it or whatever. But there's this whole bit about where that Vicki Vale is working out. Mm-hmm. And she's in good shape. And there's this panel of her where she is in this absurdly short dress for working at an office. And she's got her legs up on the desk in a way that really would be inappropriate in any office setting, unless maybe you worked at Penthouse or whatever. And you've got Julia kind of admiring her. She's someone like your new body, Vicky, since you started going to that health spa. Mm-hmm. Such a catty compliment, Julia. At least someone noticed. And it's like, when I see that at this age, I'm like, All right. Like Julia, that doesn't just seem like one woman admiring another, just the way Mandrake draws it. It's like, yeah. I don't know. It feels like there's a little more there than maybe what Menick was in suggesting. But now you're talking about with the stalagmite and stalactite. Like, well, maybe not. He might have been throwing that in there too.
Yeah, I thought about that too, that exact panel, because all I was waiting for was the guy to knock on the door and be like, I've got your pizza, ladies. Like, I was like, this is, I mean, archetypally the opening to a porno. And I was like, okay. And I did the same thing. I'm like, well, Mandrake's taking some creative license and he draws a pretty girl, so that's cool. But no, the rest of the issue, and then, I mean, not to jump too far ahead, but, you know, Jason Todd is at school. And he's sitting at the lunch table with his buddies, and they're talking about this group of kids who ran into this pale lady, Nocturna, at the observatory. And Jason doesn't pick up on it's her until one of the boys says, but she was really hot. My brother said he wants to sleep with her. And Jason's like, Nocturna. And I'm like, oh, really? Like, that's when you realized it?
And that's the connection you made there when somebody said that? Yeah.
Well, and then at the end, you know, she's on the ledge of the observatory, and Mandrake draws her in, like, full cheesecake pinup. And Jason's coming around the corner, and then he, like, puts his head on her shoulder, and he calls her mom. And I'm like, oh, no, those two panels don't belong on the same page. So I think there was definitely some weird stuff going on in the Bat office at this time. And it's funny, like you said, when I bought this book off the rack, I didn't pick up on any of this. All I remember, and I vividly remember this, is Batman being like, oh, I love Nocturna. Oh, I love Selina. Oh, Vicky's kind of cute. Oh, there's always Julia. And I remember that, you know, because that's just not something we see in him anymore. But I did not remember just how strange this issue was. And so it was kind of fun to revisit. And it's kind of fun to see a Batman from a different era, which, you know, we're never going to see this again from him.
No, no.
Yeah, the version we get now is like – and I love this version, but it's like Tom King, where it's like emotional and, you know – and these in-depth, you know, plumbings into his mind and his soul. But we're never going to get a Batman again who's like, all right, ladies, you know, who's the next one on the list? Like, so it's kind of fun to see that.
Yeah, it is true that sequence where he brings Selina back to the Batcave and he shows her the formation, the rock formation. It's a Batman we're not used to, at least if you've been reading Batman over the last 20 years like you just talked about. Because he is kind of like a doofus, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, he kind of doesn't really have any real game.
No.
In terms of, and it kind of reminds me, I don't know if you've ever seen the 40-year-old virgin.
Oh yeah.
But it's like that scene of where they're playing poker and like they're all trying to talk about the sex they've had, and Steve Carell of course has no experience, but he's trying to fake it, and he's like, breasts, they're like giant bags of sand, and like the other guys are like, what?
Yeah.
And that's like, Batman really comes across as like this kind of doofus that has just no idea how to talk to women. I mean, he's just like, here's this statue, look at it, where I think we're gonna be together, right? And then she's like, not tonight, no, not in our lifetime. Well, why did you bring me here? Like,
it's just so weird.
A strange Batman.
It really is. And you're right, he is. And he even thinks earlier, he's in his, you know, it's Bruce Wayne, and he's thinking about Jason Todd, and the whole Nocturna arc, Bruce has been trying to adopt Jason. And it's supposed to go through smoothly, but then Nocturna tries to adopt him because she's kind of a grifter and she wants some of Bruce Wayne's money. She doesn't know he's Batman at that moment. And so there's been this whole weird thing about Jason's adoption. So Bruce has finally gotten to adopt him at this point, but Jason's really lamenting not having a female figure, a mother. And I'm like, oh, so Alfred doesn't count? Like, what are you? Like, screw you, Jason. And so, you know, like, yeah, just wait, you know, a couple months, man. I'll be calling that 1-800 number. And so you and I both, actually. I think you're the only other person I've ever met who did.
That's right. You're proud of it.
And so there's this whole undercurrent, this whole plot. And at one point, Bruce Wayne thinks, you know, I realize that, you know, I can't get over the fact that only my failure as a man has come between me and my relationship with women, and I really need to find a mother for Jason. And I'm like, oh, this is so uncomfortable. Like, now suddenly you're looking at these multiple women you've been juggling, and you're like, well, one of them can come in and raise my ward, who I'll send into bullets and danger every night. And I was like, right. Oh, this is so weird. I just – yeah, I I will say Doug Munch or whatever, he definitely – he always has that little bit of a weird side to his writing, which is some of the things I like about him. But it's just funny how it's playing out in this seemingly more innocent time. And it, you know, definitely – it's not the heart of the book, and it's, you know, definitely not the thing I want people walking away from it, you know, with, because the Nocturna arc is pretty cool. But it's just weird.
She seems to be one of the few – I mean, I haven't really read too many Batman comics of the last couple of decades at this point. But, I mean, as far as I understand, Nocturna has never come back. Like, no one's ever brought her back and done anything with her, which is kind of remarkable because it seems like everything that is old is new again, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like – and Night Slayer, too. Yeah. I love – I don't think – character-wise, there's not a lot there. But the visual of Night Slayer is, to me, one of the great – simple designs. I mean, he's basically just a black bodysuit, and then all of the detail is rendered in Zippitone. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, to me, it's like he looks fantastic. I mean, every time you see him in a panel, he's designed by Gene Colan, he looks super cool. But I don't think either one of these characters have ever been written in a Batman comic not by Doug Mensch, I think. I think this is like he used them and that was it.
Well, and it's strange because both visuals are so stunning, right? Like Nocturna is a really cool visual. I mean, you know, she's this like alabaster white, always dressed in black with this like, you know, raven black hair. And even just that is like, oh, she's got to come back. I mean, she's just so cool looking. You know, she's really interesting. And then, you know, you said the Night Slayer, Anton, her brother, is not super interesting, but I don't know if you know this, like the origin of Nocturna and Anton, it's a spoof on Follow the House of Usher by Edgar Allan Poe. Munch is doing a whole kind of – his whole weird Gotham version of that story. And I didn't obviously pick up on that when I was a kid. I hadn't read that story. But in rereading it, I went back all the way to the beginning of her arc. And at one point when she's first introduced, Lucius Fox even says she has a skin condition that makes her sensitive to light. And they say, oh, like the guy in that Poe story, Fall of the House of Usher. And it was such a clunky line that I was like, what? And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. Brother, sister, weird relationship. The sister appears dead. She's a deathly pallor. The home is the symbol of their sort of cracking, you know, great family name. And then there's a whole part in the story where the sister is entombed, but she might still be alive when it happens. And that all kind of plays out in how Nocturna and Night Slayer's arc end. So I was like, oh, okay, that makes this a little cooler. I'm like a little more interested in that. But I don't know that he ever really plays it up too much. I mean, it's not something he didn't need the reader to know the story, but it added a little extra layer for me.
That had never popped into my head at all. That's awesome. I love that. I love that he did that. That's great. I mean, you're right. It works without it, but that's really cool. I'd never made that connection before. So,
oh, I hadn't either until I reread and then I saw the line in her first introduction, and I was like, oh, I'm like, he's totally doing this. This is kind of cool. And there's also it kind of justifies. I mean, I joked about it earlier, but like Nocturna and Night Slayer, it could not be more purple prose. Like it is.
Yeah.
So,
oh yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. It's like they're speaking live journal. Like it is the most ridiculous dialogue I have ever read. But at one point Bruce calls her out on it when he first meets her. And he's like, no one talks like that. Like, what are you? He's like, you're a little melodramatic. I mean, he flat out says to her, you're really melodramatic. And she's like, melodramatic like the night. And he's like, yeah, okay, he's like, whatever. He's like, that sounds great. So I kind of – that part really bugged me, but I let it go a little bit because I was like, all right. He's kind of evoking the elevated language of Poe and Follow the House of Usher, but it's a little silly, you know, and it takes itself a little too seriously. But he took a shot at himself kind of jokingly, so I'm okay with it.
Yeah, when Jason approaches her at the end and she says, sit with me, Jason. I'm cold and I'm disturbed. Okay, all right. This is kind of like a goth chick that you knew back in high school or whatever. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is a girl who was way too into Neil Gaiman in like ninth grade. Yeah, I knew this girl well. And actually, I really wanted to date this girl, but she was too cool for me, which tells you everything you need to know about me.
I'm raising my hand right now. Yeah, and art-wise, I do want to talk about the art. Talk about Tom Mandrake. Of course, he is a graduate of the Joe Kubert School. So,
oh, cool.
JKS represent. He's one of these guys who I don't – you called him sort of the bastard son of Gene Colan, which, again, I think he would take as a compliment. But he's one of these guys when I look at his stuff and I'm looking back at this particular issue as he has a style that is so distinctly his own. I mean, to me, mm-hmm. nobody else looks like Tom Mandrake. No other artist looks like Tom Mandrake. There's some stuff where his – exaggeration is so wild and seemingly so kind of out of control that I think another artist who was in lesser command of his gifts, because he's doing the inking too here, I think it would collapse because it would just look ridiculous. But there's something about you're living in the Tom Mandrake Batman world, and it all seems to make sense. I mean, the opening splash page where Catwoman is chasing the guy in the Frankenstein mask, the second panel when he has her running, she's 3 feet in the air.
Mm-hmm.
She looks like she's flying. And then the third panel, you see a close up of her and her mask, and her cat ears are comically large. I mean, she looks like Rabbit Woman, not Catwoman. And I think a lot of other artists, if they try to draw it that way, it just wouldn't look right. But when you do it under Tom Mandrake, it just sort of all feels like it's okay. This is the world of Batman as filtered through Tom Mandrake, and it makes sense as a piece. But there's parts of it where you're like, boy, this anatomy's a little wonky. This you know, there's a point where Nocturna kicks the one punk guy.
Oh, yeah.
Her leg is kind of – I don't know where her leg is coming from exactly, because it's like right in front of the guy's face. But yet it all kind of hangs together.
Yeah, I love Tom Mandrake, and I've actually – I've always lamented that he isn't a bigger deal, that he wasn't sort of better remembered as one of the greats of this time period. And he falls into – and this is the thing I loved about this issue. He falls into like a very specific school for me of like the Brent Anderson – I would see like Anderson, Mandrake, the people, Dennis Cohen, the people whose people in their books look like actual people. Like, he's not drawing the same face and same body style. Like, everybody in this book is distinct, and actually even grotesque. Like, Harvey Bullock is grotesque.
Yes.
In this issue. And he's supposed to be. I mean, there's this whole running gag. He's having this conversation with Commissioner Gordon, and he's trying to open a bottle of ketchup to put on a hot dog. And he spurts it all over the counter and all over his shirt and all over his hand. And it's kind of more of a play on the whole symbolism of red in the issue being, you know, oppressive and bloody. But it's also a great little bit of acting. And I love that about Mandrake. I think you nailed it. When you read a Mandrake comic, you're in his universe. And you either – it's kind of like Kelly Jones too. You either accept it or you fight against it. And it's easier if you just accept it because it's really beautiful.
And he's great at using very, very heavy blacks. I mean, of course, it's a Batman comic. You're going to use a lot of heavy blacks. But even the opening page where Batman is talking to Commissioner Gordon, it doesn't look like Gordon has any lights on in his office except for this one little spotlight that Batman is standing in. And so everything is this moody, shadows-drenched film noir kind of world. And there's the scene where Robin is in the observatory, and there's this circular stairwell over him that's casting these large, you know, ominous shadows. So it's got, again, it has the very film noir kind of feel. And then at the same time, Harvey Bullock is wearing magenta pants and a bright green blazer. I mean, he's in the Hulk, Luthor, Joker kind of color scheme, Brainiac color scheme. So it's everything is kind of day glow colored, but then also deeply moody and weird and strange. And I would say that Mandrake probably is not as remembered as fondly as, say, like Norm Breyfogle or something like that, where people are like, oh, that was one of the great runs or whatever. But yeah, I mean, it had a really distinct look. I certainly loved it at the time. And I was buying both Batman books. I mean, this story continues into Detective Comics 556, and Manic was writing that too. Which is unusual to have the same writer doing both books. And it's sort of – I look at this, you know, it came out in 1985. And we all know that in terms of popular culture or the arts, you know, the decade that came just before doesn't stop at the last day of the year. It's not like the 70s stopped on December 31st, 1979. They continue on into the first couple of years of the 80s and so on and so on. And I look at Doug Menick and I say, this is a guy who just was – not really interested in probably playing that large crossover game that would come to dominate comics pretty quickly. And so you look at 1985 and you say the fact that he was the single writer for Batman in 1985 shows you that like his style was, you could argue for good or for bad, on its way out.
Yeah.
Kind of at a certain point, but he was one of the last guys to still be sort of hanging on and doing these comics. And it is kind of remarkable. Like, again, this is 4 years before the Batman movie, But and so Batman was probably still kind of like DC was like, okay, you know. But it's kind of amazing that they would hand one of their marquee characters over to so singular a writer and so mm-hmm. kind of a guy that was going to just follow his own sort of muse. And again, I'm not trying to slight other writers and saying, oh, they were just hacks that just did it. But Menick's stories read like Menick stories.
Yeah.
And it's, again, I can't picture Batman being handed over to somebody so singular nowadays. I just can't because there's just so much more corporate structure on top of it. But I think in 1985, there was no movie. There was no, you know, they were just like, okay, let's have Doug do Batman. He's doing a good job. Let's keep it going.
Well, and you know, people forget that at this point in time, Batman was not a huge seller. I mean, it was a popular character, but it was not, you know, selling like the X-Men or Teen Titans or anything. And I'm glad you pointed this out because Menick for me, and in reading this, and actually, like I said, I went back and read the whole Nocturna arc. It's almost like they got a 70s film director to write Batman. It's almost
right,
like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the kind of – like those movies, like Dog Day Afternoon or something. Like those kind of movies, those 70s type where it's like there's this undercurrent of kind of danger and weirdness. There's – the hero is in quotes. And, you know, stuff just isn't going to turn out okay. It's way more interesting to have it turn out the way it really should than the way you want it to. And that's what his stuff reads to me like. It's like watching a really good 70s film. And I love that now. And at the time I did because, I collected this book regularly. And he was writing – he wrote Detective and Batman from 83 to 86. And then actually DC brought him back in the 90s. He did a run from like 92 to 98.
Oh, I didn't even think I knew that. Wow. Good for him.
Yeah, he wrote over 160 issues of Batman. Like he is one of them. He's like Chuck Dixon level prolific when it comes to Batman. Though, you know, like you said, people don't really talk about him. But I loved it. I love that gritty kind of 70s feel. It's the same thing I loved. I mentioned this before already, but like The Question by Denny O'Neill and Dennis Cohen in the 80s. It feels to me like in this same universe. Like they're happening in the same city, basically. And I loved it. I love that about this issue. I love getting back to see, you know, Mandrake's work. And like I said, you know, he draws the red skies in a way that is more terrifying than really anything outside of, you know, Perez, anything outside of like, I think Crisis One, when like Ultraman gets swallowed by the antimatter cloud. Like that's the only other time I think I found it as terrifying as I do in this little run.
Well, like I said, he did the job he was supposed to do. This book is relatively unique in that I've talked about in a bunch of previous episodes about how one of the hallmarks of these Mountain Comics is that they were issues of series that I normally wouldn't buy because, A, I was buying a lot more comics when I was on vacation because I needed more to read, and, B, because I had access to so many more newsstands up there, I was getting a hold of books that I never saw at home. You know, I was like, oh, wow, what's Arrak, Son of Thunder? Okay, I'll pick that up and kind of thing. But Batman was the opposite of that. Batman, of course, being Batman, was always available. Mm-hmm. And Batman was a book I regularly bought. And so this was just one of the ones I was like, oh, this is the next Batman. I'll just pick it up. So, I mean, I had Batman 388. I had Batman 390. And I bought those both at home when we were back in New Jersey. But this was the one where I was like, okay, this is the next one available. And I picked it up. So, I mean, again, there was no – if a newsstand is selling comics, they're going to sell Batman. That's just one of the de rigueur titles that's going to come along in the box.
Which is great. I mean, and that's why I think, you know, when I look back at my collection, I have these like very spotty runs of some other books. You know, I think I have Firestorm issue 2 and then issue 34. Like, you know, which is like the epitome of collecting from the newsstand, right? But yeah, I have a pretty good run from this point forward. And I love the way, I don't know, if did you read how this arc ends? Because it's just the next two issues.
I didn't follow up on it, but I do remember vaguely what happened. But why don't you get into it, what exactly how they wrapped this up? Because you're right. I mean, this is a huge arc and we're right at the very end of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for people who are listening who haven't read it, you know, this particular issue is the middle part of an arc. Like it's the setup for the setup. And so, you know, Robin and Nocturna, she's at this observatory and they established from the beginning, she was, this is what cracks me up. She was a kid, but her parents died. So she lived on the street and then a wealthy man, it sounds sinister, but then it turns out not to be. A wealthy man sees her panhandling and like takes her home when she's 12 and you're like, uh-oh. But then he's like, no, he raises her as her own. And so she grows up really wealthy and then he dies and it turns out he was a master criminal. And so she wants to be a criminal because she lives this luxurious life and literally her whole goal is, well, I can't go back to I have to have luxury. Like I can't go back. Once you've had a fur coat, you can't wear a jacket. And you're like, well, that's kind of, you know, But then she's also an astronomer. like she's like – it's the weirdest – it's like the Barbie of bat characters. It's like master criminal, you know, lacks, you know, a melanin, and then also is an astronomer and, you know, has a dream car or actually has a hot air balloon. And so –
that's right, yeah.
So anyway, her arc opens at the observatory, and that's how Bruce Wayne meets her, because they've taken over the observatory, their funding, and he kind of meets her through there. So the fact that she comes back to it at the end here is really – symbolic, and also kind of back to the fall of House of Usher, where there's the crack in the house, and it grows throughout the story, and at the end it splits the house in two as the narrator drives away. This is kind of the same deal. So she, you know, the skies have turned red. The Night Slayer is out there trying to kill her. Now, he is her adoptive brother, and they were lovers, and he went to jail. Batman caught him, and then she like made a move on Batman. So the Night Slayer gets out, finds out, wants to kill her. It's really, really troubling. Kind of very Greek, and so anyway, she goes to this observatory in this issue in 389. Jason Todd finds her, and then the Night Slayer gets to her, and it's kind of one of those stories where everybody gets to the observatory. Like Bullock is there, Jason Todd, Batman, Catwoman, the Night Slayer, and she actually allows herself to be murdered by the Night Slayer. She actually stands in front of him and says, "Like, kill me." And as her dialogue is really interesting, because she's like, these red skies, because she's an astronomer, she's like, these red skies are not natural. Like, there's nothing causing this in nature. It's the death of the night. And she thinks of herself as the night. So she's like, well, the night is dying, so I need to die, and it should be at your hands. And so he stabs her multiple times. Like, it's really visceral and really disturbing. And Batman and Catwoman go to try to save her and Robin, and lightning strikes the observatory, and it splits in half, just like in the Poe story. And Jason carries her body. And you don't know if she's alive or dead. And he puts her in the hot air balloon that she uses to travel through Gotham, which is way silly to say out loud, but is kind of interesting in the comic. And he just sends it out into the sky like she's frickin' Ozma the Great. Like, he's just like, here you go. Like, you know, find peace. And I'm like, dude, Jason, she might be savable. Like, take her to a hospital. Don't send her into the air, you moron. Like, this is why you won't last. And he just puts her into the air. And then lightning – that like later on – they show the balloon shredded by the violent lightning and the basket like on the ground, and that's just it. And then Night Slayer seemingly is killed as well in the collapse of the observatory. So it ends very kind of Poe, very Shakespearean, really dark. And then like you said, she's just never really heard from again. And so I love that about this arc. I love that Menick and Mandrake were like, oh yeah, this isn't going to be a happy ending. This isn't like Nocturna's the recurring villain of the month.
Right,
this is a story. These two have always been destined to kill each other. It's very like Flowers in the Attic. Like, these two have always been very destined to kill each other. We're going to let that play out, and we're going to show you – like, we'll leave it a little ambiguous, but, you know, pretty much we're going to show you the violence of their ending. So I for people who haven't read it, I would highly recommend it as a really cool look at pre-crisis Batman. Amazing Tom Mandrake art. And actually, Gene Colan's on the book before him, so – I was joking about him being related to Gene Colan, but it's a purposeful choice, and it's just so good. It's really overwritten. The prose is really purple, but it's also super fun, and it's cool to see like an imperfect Batman kind of chasing his tail for a while. And so I like it a lot. I was really excited when you had this issue kind of up for grabs.
It does sound silly when you say it about the hot air balloon, but then you think about it and you're like, well, but Menick is referencing, you just talked about Poe, which is this old timey thing. It would have been weird if like she gets in a car. Because of course, in any Poe movie, you know, there aren't those things. You know, it's set back in an older time, so it has a kind of like almost old timey Jules Verne kind of feel, yes. Like more from the 1800s kind of things. So it said when you hear it out loud, it sounds incredibly goofy, but when you read it, you were like, okay, you know, I'm sort of going along with this. And then the other thing I think about, which is completely disconnected to that, but nevertheless, are there any brother and sister pairs in comics that aren't tragic? I can't think of any. Because, like, yeah. Nocturna and Night Slayer are destined to kill one another. North Star and Aurora, like, I think they're a little too into each other. Vision and Quicksilver. Quicksilver is such a hothead, and she's always having to kind of, like, oh, Pietro, calm down. Geo-Force and Terra.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Is there any brother and sister that are, like, just got along? I can't think of any off the top of my head.
Yeah, it is weird. The sibling relationships are weird. Even, like, brothers. Even Havoc and Cyclops and... But yeah, there's always a weird undercurrent in those sibling dynamics that I don't like. Like, if my sister were a superhero and I were a superhero, I'd be like, awesome. Like, this is great. Like, I wouldn't have all the angst of, you know, Pietro and Wanda. But no, I think you're right. And this one in particular, there it's bizarre because when she's first introduced and she's telling her backstory, Anton, who's the Night Slayer, Anton Knight, he comes back. Their father, quote unquote, dies, her adoptive father, his actual biological father. And Anton comes back from the funeral and they've never met. And he's like, oh, my father wrote me these letters about you and how he had adopted you and how you had brought all this great joy to his life. But I was in the Orient learning the secret art of karate. And it's like, what? It's so weird. And then he has this great 70s mustache that is like, I mean, like Tom Selleck's mustache is intimidated by it. Like, it's just big and burly. And at one point he pretends to be Batman. He thinks he's Batman after he's injured. And he dons the Batman costume with the mustache. And it is the best visual ever.
That's a great visual.
Oh my God.
Batman with a mustache is just fantastic.
It's like Smokey and the Batman. Like, it's the best thing ever. And so there's so much silliness in this arc, and the arc is taking itself very, very seriously. But Menick is a good enough writer, and Colin and Mandrake are obviously good enough artists that if you just say, okay, it's pre-crisis, I'm going with it, it's really good. It's really worth reading.
Absolutely. I agree. Well, I think that is going to do it for Batman number 389. If you out there can think of a brother and sister pair in comics that are not tragic, please leave a comment on the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. Go to the tab for the FW Present Show, and you'll find gallery post. Oh, there's a gallery post for this episode. You'll see some pages from this very comic. So, Sean, thank you so much for coming back. I really appreciate it. Where can people find you on the internet?
Thanks for having me, man. So I am on the Pulp to Pixel podcast network. I am the co-host of Secret Wars and Beyond with Greg Arujo. And we cover every Marvel superhero Secret Wars miniseries. We covered the beautiful gem that is volume one, the turd in a hot dog that is volume two. My metaphor got away from me. And we're leading up to volume three, the Hickman Eastside Rubik run, which is awesome. But we're taking a little break in the meantime to prep, and we're covering the amazing Squadron Supreme miniseries by Mark Gruenwald and Bob Hall. We also have What If Cast, hosted by my buddy Dr. G, where he has guests on. They talk about their favorite issues of What If, which is super cool. And yeah, it's a fun network. You can also find me on Twitter at Sean42AZ, which is super boring. But anyway, you know, look me up, and I would love to hear people's ideas about Batman 389 and about the Batman of pre-crisis DC, which is in some ways way more interesting, and in other ways, I don't know.
What else can you say? No, absolutely. And I enjoyed the first episode of the Squadron Supreme show. That is a miniseries that is long overdue for someone to cover on a podcast form. So that's great that you guys are doing it. That's been very, very enjoyable. So thanks everybody for listening. Of course, we are always talking about Mountain Comics. That has its own Twitter feed because of course it does. That's at Mountain Comics. And again, you can go to the website and you can subscribe to FW Presents, which is again, is our omnibus show where we have all sorts of different content flowing through there. And you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher. And like I said, go to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, and leave us a comment and let us know what you thought about this particular issue of Batman. So thanks everybody for listening. Sean, I assume you're going to go back to the hot tub and just stay there till season four of Mountain Comics, which is fine. So we will see everybody later, and take it easy. Bye. Shut.